ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Afternoon, Selena Green. Again with you today. We're going to have a dairy focus in this half an hour, because we've got the Dairy SA Central Conference underway in the Adelaide Hills today, so it's a pretty good chance to take some stock of how the industry is travelling.
We are seeing the market improve a bit, which is a positive sign, but the reality is that our market is nowhere near what it was 12 months ago. We've been talking to our farmers for some time now to say, well, look, let's scenario plan for a lower milk price. What would that mean for your business?
More on that to come. And in this half an hour, I'll check in on the fat farmer. Which, before you go, Selena, that's not very politically correct. It's a real thing, it's a great concept, and it's taking off across Australia. We'll hear more about it before this half an hour is up. Always happy to hear from you on my talkback number, which is 1300 222 891, or the text line 0467 922 891. But first, as I said, the Dairy SA Central Conference is happening today in Harndorf. One of the key speakers there is Eliza Redfern, an analysis and insights manager working with Dairy Australia. As we speak, she's delivering a market update and outlook. So I caught up with Eliza earlier and asked her if there was still some optimism in dairy coming off the back of some good seasons.
Yeah, definitely. So what we're currently seeing within the Australian dairy industry at the moment is this recovery in milk production. We're also seeing that the volume sold of a lot of dairy products in the different key dairy categories in the retail space are also growing. And we're also starting to see a rebound in export pricing as well. So these are probably the key things that are driving a fair bit of optimism in the industry at the moment.
So let's look at the situation and outlook, but first perhaps looking more globally rather than domestically, the global situation and outlook at the moment, where are things at?
Yeah, so, you know, we've been dealing with, I guess, a pretty weak global economy for quite some time now, especially over the last 2 years, and essentially that continues to limit importing activity of dairy products, particularly from buyers in key dairy exports. So ultimately, you know, that's been a weight on the export markets. But what we have been seeing is, you know, this rebound in commodity prices, which has really been driven by this lack of global supply growth. So essentially looking ahead over, you know, into the coming months, that lack of supply growth is likely to be that largest supporting factor for commodity prices.
What about here domestically in Australia? How does that then flow on to what Australian producers can expect?
Well, you know, the domestic market here in Australia does continue to perform quite strongly for the dairy supply chain. We've been seeing that the volume sold of cheese, dairy spreads and yogurt have been growing over the last 12 months. So essentially, you know, inflation is still quite high. There is still that high cost of living that consumers are dealing with and still are adjusting to. But essentially that increased volume sold of those dairy products within those categories is likely to help support that value retention across those categories while, you know, that there's still these economic constraints in the background.
Yeah, good news that consumers are turning back to some of these products, but do the competition from cheap imports continue to be a challenge for Australian producers?
So we've seen that imported dairy products are still coming into Australia, and that's always been a feature of our country. But over the last season, we did import you know, the largest volume or largest tons of imported dairy products. And essentially that's really centred around that competitiveness of Australian dairy products in comparison to the cheaper imports from New Zealand or US or Europe. So ultimately, you know, looking ahead, those global dynamics are likely to pressure the Australian market and especially when it comes to farm gate milk prices for the 24-25 season, there's likely to be some pressure there as well.
You talked about milk production has picked back up again and is increasing. Where does it sit sort of in comparison to the highs of previous years?
Yeah, it's a good question. So what we've seen this season is that our milk production has grown every month so far, and there's really two sort of key points there. Firstly, around better than expected weather conditions, particularly over the first half of summer in a lot of dairying regions. But that milk production has also been against some lower comparable figures of last season. And we know that last season, milk production was impacted quite significantly by repeat flood events in multiple regions. So essentially, because of the growth that we've had this season so far, we are expecting that Australia's national milk production will grow slightly this season. So that means likely to end the 23-24 season close to that 1%. Above the volumes produced last season, which will take us to about the 8.2 billion litre mark.
And you're presenting a lot of this at the conference here in South Australia today. Where do you see South Australia, or what role do you see for the South Australia in all of this, in this supply?
Yes, well, South Australia has been tracking along fairly well this season too. I mean, looking at production figures, in January, milk production was up 3.1%, so that's against January of last season. And on a season-to-date or a year-to-date basis, production is up about that 1%, just under 1% there. So South Australia, you know, has been experiencing those favourable conditions in the first half of summer. But what we are starting to see now is with that below average rainfall, particularly over February, conditions are starting to dry out. There is a little bit more demand for supplementary feed across the state. And essentially that's likely to put a bit of pressure on feed costs there.
In the coming months, of course, it will be that sort of busy time when all eyes turn to opening prices for the season. What should producers be bracing for, do you think, with those opening prices?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we've had two seasons now of relatively high farm gate milk prices. And, you know, that's helped contribute to back-to-back profitable seasons for a lot of dairy farmers. But essentially, a lot has changed over that time too. We've seen that, you know, the global markets have changed quite significantly. They've fallen quite significantly over that time. And so ultimately, you know, we are likely to see that Australia is likely to move more in line with where those global markets are due to that competitive pressure that we've had on Australian dairy products. So there is likely to be, you know, some adjustment in farm gate milk prices there, which ultimately will put some pressure on farm margins coming into the 24-25 season.
That's Eliza Redfern, Analysis and Insights Manager with Dairy Australia, and she's one of the presenters at today's Dairy SA Central Conference. Well, sticking with dairy, and Australian dairy prices are higher than many competitors around the world. It's pushed up imports, pushed up prices at the supermarkets, and it's helped farmers through a period of high inflation. One major milk processor is warning that if things stay the same, the Australian milk price is going to drop. Warwick Long sat down with Matt Watt, Farm Source Director at Fonterra Australia, to talk milk price, farm production, and the Australian market.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fascinating year, and I think that's the same story for dairy year over, right? We always get to this time of the year and say, wow, it's different again. And our job, firstly, is to set up a business that can handle that. So over the last, well, 6-8 years now, we've been continuing to focus on the things that mean we can deliver a good milk price, make a shareholder return, and produce products that Australian consumers want to produce. So that means focusing on our strengths in retail, in cheese and food service. But we can't be blind to the international aspects, as you say. So we are seeing some improvement there, which is good to see. We saw New Zealand actually increase the forecast by 30 cents a kilo kiwi. So the midpoint is now 780 kiwi, equates to about a 720 Aussie. So still a bit below where we are here, but GDT's up by 10% in the last sort of since December. Long way from where it was this time last year. So we've got to factor that in just in terms of how we're just managing our way through.
Is it more difficult or something else since the mandatory code has come in for you to try and manage the amount of milk supply that you're getting and where it's coming in?
I think it's different difficult, if I'm honest. I mean, on one hand, you know, we know and we often joke about some of the, you know, media and the focus on June 1 and opening prices and all of those things, right? And that's a difficult period and it's intense. But the difference is that once we get to into July, then our milk's contracted, our farmers have certainty, we have certainty, and we still have to deal with the seasonal variations, but that means we can then run a business and meet consumer demand. So
you largely know what milk you're going to have and what products you're going to have for the next 12 months. That must be some form of security.
That's right. So I think that there's aspects of the code that we can look at, and we should always try and review things. But, you know, our job is to work within the environment we've got and the codes here, so we set up a business to do that.
Are you happy with the amount of milk you're getting from Australia at the moment?
We are. I mean, we've seen, you know, the milk pool come off by close to 10% in the last couple of years. Within that, we've been able to maintain our volumes, grow our market share slightly, and that's meaning that we're able to satisfy those key demand channels I talked about earlier with consumer, food service, and then our specialist customers.
And that's the interesting thing, right? And the consumer is a huge part of your business, right? Cost of living crisis at the moment in Australia. We've seen dairy prices and even the most basic cheese and butters going up at the customer shelf this year. Is that something that you have to manage?
Absolutely. So on one hand, we're looking at the farm suppliers you talked about, but on the other hand, we're always forecasting demand. What are the sort of decisions that consumers are making? What kind of pack format are they going to? For us, we do a number of strong brands, and that gives us good strength in the category, but consumers shift their decision and their purchasing. So we're always balancing that.
We're coming closer to June and July, yep. and that milk price merry-go-round comes again. What should farmers be expecting from companies like yours when it comes to hearing opening prices for next season?
As we said, we are seeing the market improve a bit, which is a positive sign. But the reality is that our market is nowhere near what it was 12 months ago. We've been talking to our farmers for some time now to say, well, look, let's scenario plan for a lower milk price. What would that mean for your business? It's still too early for us to give a view, and we'll tell our farmers first, obviously. A lot can happen in the market in 3 or 4 months. And, you know, we hope the market continues to improve between now and then.
But if things stay as they are at the moment, and given nothing stays the same, but if it stayed as they are, farmers would be looking at some form of price reduction?
Well, I would expect so. If nothing moved from this point in time, you'd have to expect a softer milk price for next season.
Is that a difficult conversation to have, given the last few years of record pricing?
Well, it is, and we talked to our supplier forum, our supplier council, which are a group of farmers, about this in November, actually. And their response is, we don't like what you're saying, Matt, but we need to hear it. So better to know the truth, even if you don't like it.
That's Matt Watt there from Fonterra Australia. It is 16 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's head back to the Dairy SA Central Conference. And amongst the guest speakers today is Brad Barnes, who is Deputy Chair at Fat Farmers. If you haven't heard of it, it's a concept that started here in South Australia to help farmers be both physically and mentally fit. He's going to be sharing the Fat Farmers message to the hundreds of attendees at the conference, but he also joins me now to share some of it with you. Brad, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks for having me, Selena.
Now, I understand Fat Farmers, it's been going for quite a while now, well over a decade, I think, at this point. How far has it managed to spread across the state?
Yeah, so it commenced in 2012 with three farmers in Maitland, SA, and now we've grown to 20 groups throughout the state and interstate. We had our first interstate group in New South Wales, and a bit of interest in sort of other areas as well outside of SA, which we're sort of looking to grow into. So, it's come a long way since that 2012.
And for those who haven't heard of the concept before, just give us a bit of an idea again of what the idea or the purpose is behind this.
Well, the purpose is really people coming together to do physical activity, whether it be personal training, a walking group, a cycling group, and we're not male or female. It's anybody, any level, coming together, doing a bit of fitness together, which we know has benefits from a mental health capacity as well. You know, getting together, that camaraderie, because farming can be quite isolating at times, and just being able to get together. And we found that people sort of exercising together also, they talk more on a higher level. If your aches and pains from a shoulder and things like that, rather than sort of being at the pub and talking pub talk, it's a more genuine conversation that you're getting out of these people. So therefore, people are feeling better supported.
How did you come to be part of this, Brad?
So Ben Wondersitz is one of our founding fat farmers, and we've been his family accountant ever since he was in business. So John Crouch, who was my mentor, was his long-term accountant, and when he sort of stepped away from the business, I took over that. And when they became a incorporated association around 3 years ago, they were looking for a treasurer. So I was the first cab off the rank. But when we came to actually put the board together, they thought my skill set, given that I had a bit of experience in boards through not-for-profits and through the client work that I do, that I'd be better suited as vice chair at that point behind Ben. So that's how I came into it.
Do you get a bit of a chance to get out there and get active with the groups as well?
Well, the annual get-together is City to Bay. So I do tend to get to that one. There's been a few other things that we supported. So we've got a bit of a barbecue trailer that one of our ambassadors, Greg Heem, sort of made up. And he was over at one of our sponsors, Emmett's in Cummins, that they're opening recently. And I went over just to help do the barbecue and stuff like that. So not getting out there to be active, but I am very rural focused in the client work that I do, particularly come the end of the year with tax planning and things like that. I've got clients in the southeast on Eyre Peninsula, in the mid north here of SA, and some that stretch to KI and into Victoria. So I don't like to sit behind my desk too much. You'll see me out on the road most of the time.
Great, and no doubt spreading the word about Fat Farmers while you're doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what you're doing today at the Dairy Conference. You're talking about it to the room. How does that go down? How do you approach that when you know farmers are so busy and trying to fit so much into their day as it is? How do you approach this whole conversation about, hey, you know, make sure that you're taking the time to stay active and look after your physical and your mental health as well?
I think Ben Wondersit, who I came back to, one of the founders, he puts it quite well in that making the time to do this, you know, whether it's once a week, twice a week, whatever you can do, actually, people that do it find that they actually can get more done in a day. So you don't have the loss of breath walking to the tractor or stuff like that. They feel like they've got more energy to do what they need to do in that day. So they're actually finding a bit of time to do this physical activity actually gets more done. So it's almost a bit of a no-brainer.
And as you mentioned earlier at the start there, this is something hoping to grow further across Australia. Great to hear that it is now, there's some interest interstate. Can you see this, you know, the potential for this to spread even further?
We're currently looking to become a registered charity, so looking to use that to expand into other areas. We've got a strategic subcommittee of our board that are looking at how we can leverage what we have to grow even further and spread the reach into other areas, teaming up with sort of like-minded organisations sort of at the same time to get the message out there.
Fantastic. Well, it's a great message. And Bradley, thanks for sharing it with us today.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Selena.
Brad Barnes, who's Deputy Chair of Fat Farmers, and you can go to fatfarmers.com to find your closest group or find out more about what they do. Let's go to the markets. Elsie Adamo has the Mount Compass report for you today. Afternoon, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Selena. Quality was extremely mixed, with more 2-score younger cattle represented as agents offered 780 live weight and open auction cattle. The bulk of the sale was represented by 372 steers, 223 heifers and 161 cows. The usual trade and processor buyers were active, along with feeders and restockers, with most prices generally unchanged for type and for condition. Vela steers sold from 251 to 310 cents, with Vela heifers ranging from 185 to 265 cents per kilogram. Yearling steers range from 220 to 305 cents, with most selling in the 265 to 305 cent bracket, as yearling heifers sold from 177 to 290 cents per kilogram. Grown steers sold from 170 to 291 cents, with most sales from 275 to 291 cents per kilogram, with grown heifers ranging from 150 to 300 cents. Light dairy cows sold from 60 to 110 cents, with light beef cows selling from 181 cents per kilogram. Medium dairy cows sold from 80 to 150 cents, with beef cows selling from 150 to 181 cents per kilogram. heavy dairy cows sold from 100 to 215 cents, as beef cows made from 157 to 261 cents. Bulls sold from 167 to 232 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo filling in for John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Elsie. It's time to head to the Weather Bureau now. Jenny Horvat, our forecaster again today. Hello, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Selena.
Much change in the weather since we last spoke?
No, not really much of a change. Still got a ridge of high pressure to the south, maintaining that milder south-southeasterly airstream. But our cloud, I guess, has contracted a little bit further north up around the pastoral districts. Didn't see too much rainfall around yesterday in the gauges, but we couldn't rule out a little bit of shower activity up across the north again for today. Remaining pretty dry and pretty cloud-free down across the southern half of the state. Was a little bit of a chilly start this morning with some of those minimum temperatures well below average for today. And we did see those minimums getting down to 1.5 of a degree at Coonawarra, 1.6 at Narracourt. So it was a little bit of a chilly start in parts. It's a little bit milder up in the north there, Oonadatta and Moomba up around 20 degrees for their minimum. So a little bit of a contrast across the state through there. But we are looking at those maximum temperatures, still looking generally below average across the state for today, with those forecast maximums ranging from sort of around the low 20s across southern parts and pushing up into just maybe sneaking around 30 degrees across the north for today. And things are relatively stable as we head into the later part of the week and the weekend. So still maintaining a ridge of high pressure across the south, so keeping us in that more southerly, southeasterly airstream as we head into the weekend. We could see some of those afternoon sea breezes freshening up a little bit and maybe even getting strong at times on Friday and Saturday afternoon. So keep an eye out for any marine warnings if you are heading out on the waters over the weekend, especially on our western coast through there. As far as our cloud goes, we will still be expecting to see cloudy periods up across the north of the state pretty much as we head into the weekend and early next week. And it is a little bit of a watch this space with some of that rainfall, about whether we see a little bit more or a little bit less. It'll all be dependent on that movement on that ex-tropical cyclone Megan. So the territory expecting still seeing quite significant rainfall, and whether we can just hook into a little bit of that around the far north of the state and up in the far northeast more likely. So we could see some of those showers tending to rain at times in the far northeast over the weekend, but it really we'll have to watch and see how that all evolves and whether it stays more on the territory and Queensland side of the border. But that moisture is still hanging around for the weekend and into early next week, and possibly even still around there on midweek. Further south though, in that onshore airstream, we are looking at dry conditions for today and tomorrow, but over the weekend we could see a little bit of light shower activity across our southern coast, and maybe even early next week a little bit of light shower activity across the south there, but not expecting too significant falls. Temperatures again remaining pretty much below average as we head into the weekend, but we might start to see some of those temperatures rising around those coastal districts early next week to more average type conditions. Just having a bit of a look at some of the rainfall that we can expect up until the end of Monday. So for those southern coasts over the weekend, generally less than a couple of millimetres, but up north we could be seeing cumulative falls of around 2 to 10 millimetres across the far north, and maybe even some local falls getting up to around 10 to 30 millimetres up in the northeast. And we still do have that flood warning for our inland rivers. We are starting to see some of that Queensland flood waters arriving into Caddy Tandy Lake air. And I guess with a little bit more rainfall up through that area over the weekend, I guess it's a bit of a watch this space for some of those outback roads and maybe some renewed flood areas through there as well, Selena.
All right, thanks for that, Jenny. Jenny Horvat there from the Weather Bureau. Looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, the upper western district expecting a partly cloudy day with a high chance of showers in the northeast, slight chance elsewhere, and there's a chance of a thunderstorm in the north. The lower western district, sunny. Now, overnight temperatures for the upper western district falling between 15 and 20 degrees. Daytime temperatures between 26 and 31. For the lower western district overnight between 9 and 14. Daytime temperatures reaching around 30 degrees. It's 12:30 here on the Country Hour.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Afternoon. Have you ever been to see Lake Eyre or had the chance to see it in all its glory? In person, I haven't been that fortunate, but the images that you see online are spectacular. But no doubt you've seen the coverage of the sheer amount of flood water around Queensland and Northern Australia, and some of that is starting to make its way south into the Lake Eyre Basin. Coming up, you'll hear about the impact of those waters for the lake, for the wildlife, and for the locals who live in the area. If you'd like to share your Lake Eyre experience with me today, my talkback number is 1300 222 891. Or the text line 0467 922 891. Also coming up, shouldn't be too hard to get your hands on some juicy South Australian grown apples. Picking is underway for some varieties. Some are about to kick off. And you'll hear about a new variety of apple that's being developed and grown right here in South Australia.
It's got a short season because I'm the only one growing it in Australia. So we pick a certain amount of bins and market them sort of over summer because it's a good apple, keeps really well. They're really fresh at this time of year.
More on that after the news headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the unemployment rate has dropped back to 3.7%. The latest Bureau of Statistics data shows there's around 116,000 more Australians in work in February. Economists were generally expecting around 40,000 extra people to be employed last month and an unemployment rate of 4%. State Parliament has set up a select committee to inquire into endometriosis treatment and research. Endometriosis is a disease which causes severe pelvic pain and is estimated to affect nearly 1 million Australian women. And a man who was found guilty of murdering his disabled wife by pushing her wheelchair into a pond has lost an appeal against his conviction. Peter Rex Danzy was sentenced to life in prison for killing his wife Helen, who drowned in a pond in Adelaide's Southern Parklands in April 2017. The sentencing judge called it an ultimate evil and despicable act of domestic violence. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for those headlines, Matt Coleman, with that news update. Well, farmers who are doing it tough are going to benefit from a funding boost to rural financial counselling. The federal government has announced $1.7 million in additional funding for the Rural Financial Counselling Service and will support services here in South Australia, as well as in the Northern Territory, New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria as well. The Federal Agriculture Minister Murray Watt said in a statement that the extra funds will help producers who've been affected by severe weather events and growers dealing with commodity downturns like the wine industry. Eliza Burlage spoke with Brett Smith. He's the Chief Executive of Rural Business Support here in South Australia about what this funding will mean for farmers who need the service.
Well, what it means, Eliza, is that we are now able to underpin the delivery of the service where the need is the most, and obviously we know that there is a significant downturn in the wine grape regions in South Australia, particularly around some of the varietals that underpin those particular regions. So the demand is not great, as we know, and that's really hurting wine grape producers in those particular areas, particularly the Riverland, where there is a significant amount of wine crush around these varietals. So we've been seeing demand increase significantly, and that's starting to outstrip our capacity to deliver and help. So the funding announcement by Minister Watt today is absolutely welcomed and very timely, because again, it helps us underpin the delivery of existing services, but also provide additional capacity where the demand is growing each day.
You mentioned increased demand for your service, for RBS's services. How much has the demand increased, and over what, in a particular time frame?
Well, look, we've probably doubled our numbers of support of clients that we're supporting over the last 12 months. So it is increasing significantly, and each client that we deal with, we can deal with that client for up to 3 or 4 years. We obviously spend a lot of time through a case management process ensuring that we can get the business into a position where it is viable and can go forward, or look at whatever the other options might be. So there's a lot of work that is involved. So each client can take up a considerable amount of time. So, you know, as the demand increases, if we have another doubling of demand, which could happen, that places a significant impact onto our organisation. So, again, this funding is going to help us be able to continue to deliver good service where it's needed.
And when you say the demand has doubled, just how many people does that look like?
Well, for us, the number now is that we're dealing with, 100 clients from Wine Grape. Now, this is not necessarily just right across all the other industries that I talked about before, but just looking at it specifically in the wine grape industry. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but as I said before, it is quite intense and involved. And it does take, each one of our counsellors can deal with around about 25 complex situations. So, you're talking about 4 resources that are committed to that particular 100 clients. Now, if that doubles again, there's another 4 resources, for example. Plus, we've got all the other things going on across the area which we look after. So, again, this funding enables us to have that extra capacity to, deal with what we think will be increased demand over the next 12 months. And through Riverland Wine and through many of the forums and community discussions, etc., people have been saying, rural financial counselling will be in high demand moving forward and will continue to be in high demand. And I think what we're seeing today, Eliza, is that the announcement from the minister is one in which government has been listening to that request and has enabled us to be able to respond not only better today, but also into the future as we believe demand will increase.
And just breaking this down, are you able to explain whether this funding will allow you to put on more counsellors, accept more clients, have more hours available?
Well, it will enable us to help underpin the existing resources that we have, but also to be able to apply more resources, i.e. more hours, etc., to respond to the demand. So it does mean increased capacity, as I've said, through being able to apply additional resources to where we have this particular situation at play.
Is this funding enough? Are you guys hoping for more?
Yeah, we're still looking at how things might play out, particularly through the state budget process. So we have additional requests and additional, requirements in that space. So, I don't think this is the end. I don't think we'll be looking for further support as we go forward, because I think, as I said, if we double again and we end up with 200 clients, and that's an additional 4 resources. So that is significant. And we need to make sure that we're on the front foot and working with federal, state, and in some cases territory government where needed to be able to ensure that we're providing them with the information that influences decision making to ensure that we've got people on the ground to be able to deliver the outcomes that are required. So we are constantly having those conversations, Eliza, and making sure that we're on the front foot and responding to what we're being told the community and clients that are impacted require.
And is this mostly targeted at people who are affected by the wine grape oversupply, or how much is it also targeting, other areas that are dealing with natural disasters?
Well, yes, there are a number of different issues that are occurring across each of the states, and I can only really talk to South Australia. And certainly we do have some other things that are happening throughout our regions here in SA. But likewise, throughout New South Wales, throughout Queensland, throughout Victoria, there's a lot of wine and grape production in those particular locations. So they're experiencing the same level of stress. And I will say, about 50% of Australia's annual wine crush is in the 18 wine regions of South Australia. So in particular, we're feeling that pinch probably a bit more. But really, the bottom line is that this also enables us to address some of the other areas where, we're still recovering from the impact of flood last year, which has caused, particularly in the lower reaches of the Murray, caused a lot of problems. And of course, you know, we have other things going on around fruit fly outbreaks, in particular in the Riverland, but also at the moment in the Adelaide Plain. So we've got those issues playing out, and, you know, livestock producers are also feeling the pinch because of the, I guess, inconsistency around livestock prices. And of course, we also have some issues with marine scale fishers, which are responding to industry reforms here in South Australia. And we've got a fairly significant outbreak with a disease in the abalone industry as well. So there's lots of things going on. And what I can say is that this funding, you know, we can focus our resources into many different areas, but it does stretch us. And we do have a big problem in the Riverland at the moment. And this mainly underpins the capacity of us to be able to deliver our services into the Riverland.
That is Rural Business Support Chief Executive Brett Smith, and he was speaking there to Eliza Burlage. And if you are someone who wishes to access this service, you can call this number 1800 836 211, 1800 836 211. It is 20 minutes to one. You're with Selena Green today. We've probably seen the big flooding in Queensland and footage of water making its way into Katitunda, or Lake Eyre as it's commonly known. It's been shared widely, but will that water actually fill the lake? Well, District Ranger for the National Parks and Wildlife Service, Travis Gotch, says that while he can't predict whether it will fill or not, it may increase the number of pests such as foxes and rabbits in the area. He told Ivy Code that there are currently plans to improve the track access to the lake and road grading should start soon. But Mr. Gotch warns travellers, who are expected to increase in numbers in the coming months, that the state of the roads is still pretty rough.
Yeah, so my understanding is that the floodwater is coming down the Warburton Creek and is hitting the Warburton Groove and is starting to push into the Warburton Groove. So that's down from the Diamantina Warburton system, and that's in response to the big flooding event that they had just at Birdsville recently and up through southeast Queensland. Cyclone Kirrily sort of came down and ran pretty much along the South Australia Northern Territory border, dumped a lot of water in the upper catchment of the Cooper and also into the Diamantina Warburton system. It then, that's the same storm that smashed Moomba and Inaminka a while back.
With more water around, mean that there'll be more of a problem with feral cats and foxes?
Yeah, look, we will see an increase in number of all the ferals in response. So pretty much they follow the rabbits. The rabbit numbers breed up with good feed and then the predators boom up. We don't get a lot of foxes north of the dog fence. You do get a few, but not many. The dingoes are very effective in controlling them. They seem to be a little bit less effective at controlling the cats, but the poor old foxes get absolutely pummeled by dingoes. They chase them for days, just for fun.
What do people need to know about access or not accessing?
So access, there's two places Lake Eyre can be accessed. Both are by public access routes that are managed by the Pastoral Board of South Australia. One of those goes out to Level Post Bay and the other goes to Halligan Bay. The Level Post Bay PAR goes up from Mooloorina near the bore drain that they've got there, the campsite at Mooloorina there. There's no camping up at Level Post Bay and it's only just reopened and there's pretty much no facilities out there and can be pretty rugged. That track, the Halligan Bay track, is supposed to be being regraded by the Pastoral Board in the next 2 weeks or so, and that'll improve the quality of the track. But that's also very rough and corrugated going out, so you want a decent four-wheel drive and, you know, well-maintained tyres and make sure you've got water, food, comms planned, or the standard fare for travelling in the outback. Let someone know where you're going, someone reliable who cares who will chase up if you don't sort of get back to them, that's for sure. There's very little facilities at Halligan Bay. You can camp at Halligan Bay. If you're camping out there, you need to have your Desert Parks pass. There's a toilet and a very minimal shelter. It's very isolated bush camping. It's for the four-wheel drive adventurer that actually wants to see the outback. And if you're looking for a five-star resort, you won't find it there. But if you're looking for an amazing bush camping experience, then, yeah, you can.
Are you expecting this water event going into the Groove to impact tourism?
It should be a boon to tourism. It won't stop people coming. Like, you know, it's certainly not going to slow people from getting up in the area to see it, not that part. Water down the Warburton Creek impacts one of the exits out of the Simpson Desert, so it means people can only get out of the Simpson Desert on the eastern side of Birdsville, so that has an impact on tourism. But for the rest of it, it's a bonus. The problem is that you really need to look at it. When it's only in the groove, the way to see it and guarantee you'll see water in the lake is by air. So taking advantage of our tour flight operators based out of Mar, you know, we've got people in Maree, we've got people at William Creek, we've got people up in Birdsville, and they all run aerial flights out over the lake. And that way you will see the water in the lake, and that does look good. But if you're coming in via land, say into like Halligan Bay campsite or something like that, there's no guarantees you'll actually see the water because it's, you know, several, like, you know, 20-odd kilometres out into the lake. And unless the wind's blowing the right way, you may not see it at all. It just looks like an empty salt lake. There is another big wet system flowing down, coming down from the north. The cyclone that came across, you know, from the Gulf of Carpentaria is pushing through. They're expecting flows up around sort of 200-300 millimetres up, rainfall around 200-300 millimetres up over Alice Springs. That's likely to push some water down. It was going to come across the Simpson, but now it's only just going to go across the edge of the Simpson, so we're downgrading some of our warnings there. But it's really important for travellers going into the outback at the moment, because we've got so much variability with the weather, with these cyclone systems coming down, a lot of instability, to make sure they're paying attention where they've got reception to see what the forecasts are. And just be aware that if big rains do come through, that you really stand a risk of being stranded. So make sure you've got plenty of water, you've got plenty of spares and food and communications, but really do have check with local knowledge and check on those devices, like apps like Windy, that give you that ability to sort of see what the weather might be doing over the next 10 days or so you're not stranded in the desert and with nobody able to get to you.
That's not the place you want to be. That is Travis Gotch there. He is the National Parks and Wildlife Service officer speaking with Ivy Code. Hello to Joe, who's at Wakery, and he's hopped on the text line, which is 0467-922-891. He says, "G'day, Selena. I was on a Rex Ellis safari back in 2011, swam in Lake Eyre, absolutely awesome, but chilly because it was in April. Would have been a bit fresh, but absolutely worth it." Oh, Joe, that sounds amazing. Thanks for your text. If you've had an experience similar or something like that with Lake Eyre, let me know. Well, those floodwaters that are making their way into Katitunda and Lake Eyre are also of great benefit to Kawari Station, which is located northwest of the lake. The water has reached them at a critical time, according to pastoralist Sharon Oldfield, allowing them to hold on to their stock. And she says she's looking forward to some spectacular sights.
Yes, they arrived about a week, 10 days ago. It's almost peaked. It hasn't started to drop yet. It's almost peaked, and it looks like it'll be quite a handy little flood.
What does this mean for you guys?
Well, it's come, to be very honest, it's come just in time. We made the decision to hold our sales last year at the crash of the market because that was about the time we were looking to sell. So, and there hasn't been, we haven't had much rain over summer, so we were about to start a destocking program. So it's come at a very timely moment in time. No, it's been wonderful.
So you are expected to have some good feed come up with the floodwaters, is that correct?
Yes, my word. So I would say that at least 50% of our flooded country would be inundated, which is very good. And I don't know, it doesn't matter how many times I see the river come down, it never ceases to amaze me that water's come from such a long way. And it's just the lifeblood. The country will just burst into pasture. And yeah, no, it is truly amazing. Like, you see the water come like it's dry, you see the water come, everything sort of bursts up, and as the water recedes, the pasture just comes, the birds come, fish in the river. No, it'll be wonderful.
Yeah, but it's a sight you don't get sick of no matter how many times you see it. That's Sharon Oldfield from Kawari Station speaking there with Kate Higgins. It's 12 minutes to one.
For all those yearnings for truly outstanding entertainment,
I have an idea of what might cheer you up.
You'll find a trove of Academy Award winning and nominated films on ABC iView.
Let's play.
Like Imitation Game.
It's beautiful.
American Sniper. Her. And Spotlight.
There's a story here, and I think it's an important story.
Brooklyn, Carol, and so many more.
Bon appétit.
Always free, always outstanding on ABC iView.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia, and Broken Hill.
Selena Green with you, bringing you the Country Hour today. Well, it's apple and pear season here in South Australia, following what can be described as a pretty interesting summer and a very hot March. Ashley Green is an apple grower in the Adelaide Hills. He's discovered a new apple variety. It's called Summer Love, and he's developing this in his orchard this year alongside some of the more well-known varieties. I had a chance to catch up with Ashley and asked him about the chance of us getting some South Australian grown apples at this time of the year.
You've actually seen South Australian apples on the shelf for some time. Gala apples have been coming out of South Australia now for about 6 weeks. Gala is the first variety that we pick, and they're generally ready early February.
So what is about to come online? Have you got other varieties that are about ready to roll out?
We'll soon be picking, well, we're picking Fuji at the moment. We're picking Granny Smith's probably next week. There are Granny Smith apples coming out of the Riverland of South Australia. We have a grower up there. Yeah, so it's all South Australian apples.
How's it all been looking as far as, you know, the weather going? Things have really dried out. We've had pretty hot March. Are the apples liked that?
People ask me all the time about whether they like the weather or not, and what we want. What we want is just a normal spring with a warmer spring with some rain, and then a nice dry warm summer, and then autumn with some rain mixed in. Autumn heat waves are not good, and it did a fair bit of damage that last weekend.
Right. So, but still, there'll still be plenty of apples.
There'll still be plenty of apples. Yes. Yep.
And I understand what this year you've got a new variety as well, Summer Love. Tell us about that one.
Obviously in big monocultures like an apple farm where you've got hectares and hectares of one particular variety and all the trees are planted close, there's lots and lots of different plants, you've got the opportunity for a genetic change. You know, we see minor ones all the time. But this one was just part of a branch. There'd been a change, and the apples there were completely different, bright red and quite different to eat. So I just happened to notice that one day passing on the tractor, and I went back a week or two later and marked the spot on the branch. And then we watched it for a couple of years. The apples came back every year in that particular spot on that branch and were quite different. Eventually we got plant variety rights granted, and we're in the process of trying to develop the variety.
Beautiful. So it's a red apple, and how would you describe the taste, if you can? I know that's a difficult thing to do, but is it like any of the other varieties?
It's a bit like Pink Lady. It's got that acid, bitey acid flavour with the sweet crunchy flesh. It's a late maturing apple, and it is quite hard and crunchy.
Have you got an expectation? Is there a likelihood around when we might be able to get our hands on some Summer Love apples on the shelves?
Yeah, we're slowly working away in the orchard, planting more and more. What we've got to do is build consumer recognition, and hopefully people remember it and buy it again next year, and you know, we'll just keep building that momentum. It's got a short season because I'm the only one growing it in Australia, so we pick a certain amount of bins and market them sort of over summer because it's a good apple, keeps really well. They're really fresh at this time of year.
But you have been able to send some of these plants off to South Africa. It is being grown there?
Yes, so we've got over 1 million trees sold in South Africa. It really suits the growers over there like it because it's such a hardy, strong apple. They can export it all around Africa without refrigeration.
That is Adelaide Hills-based apple grower Ashley Green. 7 minutes to 1. Well, today is the International Day of Forests. And in a timely bit of news, forestry company 141 has just completed an $8 million upgrade to its tree nursery at Glencoe in the state's southeast. Now, this project will allow the company to grow about 6 million trees a year in pots at the nursery rather than outside in the plantations. It should make life a bit more pleasant for its workers in the cold southeast wintertime. Nursery manager Craig Tawney says it's the first major investment in this nursery since it opened around 40 years ago.
Well, it's revolutionary change in the sense that previously, from forever,
the seedlings have been grown in the ground and have to have been harvested like any normal agricultural crop. We're now moving to full containerisation, so the trees are now, every single tree is now grown in a pot and above the ground.
So that means that what they have like perfect weather conditions and there's like less risk of things going wrong?
Yeah, certainly not perfect weather conditions because they're still grown outside, but it allows us to control all aspects of their growth and it allows us to provide a much safer and friendlier working conditions for our workers.
And it's also, I imagine it would be good for the business if you can produce more trees and do it more efficiently?
Yes, definitely. Well, we're producing around 8 to 9 million trees a year and we're doing those all above ground on benches in a footprint something like about 10% of the original nursery footprint. So it's much more efficient and much safer and better for our people.
It could sow up to 1 million trees per week. So has it still got a lot more capacity to grow from what you're doing now?
Well, the site is 85 hectares and we're currently, the current expansion is only on about 10 hectares. So we've got a lot more room to go if we ever wanted to. The sowing part of it is separate in the sense that we can, the equipment we've purchased as part of the modernisation project allows us to sow 1 million a week, but then that's capped on what we need to grow to replenish the forest, which is usually annually about 5 to 6 million trees.
Previously, we've said it uses less water or less chemicals than the previous process?
Yes, that's right, because previously, being field grown, they were just watered by conventional agricultural sprinklers, which obviously allowed for a lot of drift and a lot of overuse of chemicals. Now these are pretty much contained in automatic boom sprinklers, so we control exactly what we put out on them and almost zero drift.
Yeah, so overall, how important would you say this is for the company and for forests in the southeast?
Well, as far as our company is concerned, which we grow 100% of the trees and it represents about 80% of our total growth, it's a complete step change as far as that's concerned in the sense that we'll be able to provide a superior seedling more efficiently and in a much safer manner.
And over winter, you'll have employees normally would have been working outdoors and, you know, pretty bad conditions sometimes in the southeast. Are they looking forward to working in this plant and, you know, being a bit more comfortable there?
Yes, they very much are. They're quite excited by that, the concept of not having to be out in the rain and the mud for 8 weeks of the year while we harvest the trees.
Do you expect, I mean, these trees last 30 years or something, but do you think if they get a really good start in this kind of process now, that that will make a difference, you know, when they're harvested or thinned out, that they'll be all a bit healthier?
Oh, definitely. It's been proven that the quality of the seedling can have a very big knock-on effect onto its end productivity.
And how common is this kind of nursery like this in Australia or around the world, or are you kind of at the forefront of doing this type of development?
Certainly within Australia, there's only a couple of us doing it at this level, and certainly some of the equipment that we've put in to handle the trees, where it's a one-off in Australia.
That is the manager of the 141 Plant Nursery in the southeast, Craig Tawney, and he was speaking there with Eugene Boisvert about their upgrade to that site. It's 3 minutes to one, which means you don't have to wait much longer to hear this voice on your radio. Nikolai Balhart's here with you for Afternoons. Hello.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I am all right. Thursday has rolled around very fast.
Yeah, it has, hasn't it? It feels like one of those weeks where things have just been... Well, it's good, though. Things have been busy. Things have been keeping us busy.
We're almost at Easter.
I know. How did that happen?
Wild.
It is one of those things, isn't it? Now, I asked you how you were. So how are you?
I'm good.
You happy?
I'm okay.
Good. That's good. Good. Because the every year, the annual World Happiness Report is published. So this is that big one that's kind of put together by the UN and a whole group of researchers, and they rank 140 nations as to how happy they are. Australia, I won't give all of it away, but we've cracked the top 10.
Okay, this is good news.
It is good news, but there's some really interesting data in there about, generally speaking, how happy you are has quite a bit to do with how old you are.
Oh.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of a difference there. So we'll find out which way it skews.
Well, yes, I'd be very interested to know.
Are you happier when you're older or are you happy when you're younger? I mean, obviously these are, you know, generalities, but the data is there. I will say, perhaps unsurprisingly, can you guess who came number one in the happiest countries in the world?
Oh, it's, we're Scandinavian.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Very, absolutely. Finland, number one.
Ah, oh, there you go.
Denmark, number two. Iceland, number three. Sweden, number four. So they're clearly doing something right.
They're doing something right. I don't know what it is, but they just nail it, don't they?
Yeah. So we'll take a look at that. And speaking of overseas influences, we'll also be talking language and linguistics this afternoon. And we're going to hear about a book that's been written by a linguist in France who was an advisor to President Macron. The title of this book is called "The English Language Does Not Exist, It's Just Badly Pronounced French." So,
only so, the French could.
Yeah, I know. What a title. So, but is there something to it? Did we just steal English from the French language? So we'll take a look at that as well.
Oh, controversial. I love it. Nicolai Bailhart's going to be with you this afternoon for those great stories and more. Thanks so much for your company today. It's just going on news time and it's 1 o'clock.
The ABC Listen app makes listening to your local ABC radio stations wherever you are as easy as, well, ABC. Tap our logo to stream us live and free.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.